Chamber and Commerce Committee to order. It is 3:17. President, Representative Shragi, McCarty, Fields, Sponholz, and Nelson. And I think Representative Snyder is online or in the process of getting online. Let's see. First up before us today is Representative Laban with the first hearing on House Bill 85 related to financial institutions. Representative Laban and Mr. Burns, thanks for being here.
Donuts there, dude. Donuts. Breeze in.
Okay.
Because Calvin knows I love donuts.
Representative Laban, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, and thank you for this opportunity to present House Bill 85. I will give a high 10,000-foot brief summary of the bill and then allow my Chief of Staff, Joe Burns, to go through the sectionals. And then we have, I hope, a few folks online from the Alaska banking community that will fill in the gaps that I might leave behind. During my 42-year banking career, I had an opportunity to work for both a federally chartered bank and a state chartered bank. And during that tenure in banking at both institutions, I learned the differences, if you will, between working at a federally chartered bank or a state chartered bank. When I was at the state chartered bank, I was sometimes frustrated by what I saw as a unlevel playing field between the bigger national banks and the smaller state banks. And my goal with this bill and working with the Alaska Bankers Association Division of Banking and other stakeholders was to level that playing field and create parity between the banking community in Alaska. And I might point out that the Alaska Bankers Association, which is made up of all seven banks in Alaska, both national and state, are in support of this bill. So with that, I'll let my Chief of Staff kind of go over the sectionals with you.
Thanks, please proceed, Mr. Burns.
For the record, my name is Joe Burns, Staff Representative Laban. Starting with Section 1, which starts on page 1, line 9, which amends Title 6, Chapter 5, this is the Alaska Banking Code. This section details the powers of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. You'll find the actual change on page 2, line 3, which is conforming language to changes made in Section 10 regarding the statutes governing the establishment of a new bank branch. And when we get to that section, I'll explain in a little more detail what that does. Section 2 is new subsection AS06-05-005. This is a new subsection to the powers of the department prohibiting the department from adopting regulations on two things. First are limitations on a credit card that a state bank issues to an officer of a state bank, which connects to Section 5 of the bill regarding lending to executive officers and in regulations that are annulled in Section 24. Secondly are regulations relating to the setting of time limits on the disposal of real and personal property, and this connects to Section 6 of the bill with regulations being annulled in Section 24. Moving on to Section 3, which starts on page 2, line 22, which amends AS06-05-050. This section governs the publication of reports. It adds the option for posting notices of publication of bank reports on a bank's internet website versus physically posting the report in the bank's lobby. And of course, the requirement that a copy of a report of condition being supplied upon request at no cost remains unchanged in this section. Going on to Section 4, this amends AS06-05-166. Subsection C, this defines the time frame, not later than 15 days, for which a bank must notify the department after an emergency non-opening or closing of the bank. Section 5, starting on page 3, lines 26 through 27, this amends AS06-05-0005. 210 subsection A. This increases the amount a director or executive officer of a state bank may borrow from their bank. It raises the limit up to $500,000. Section 6 amends ASO 605245, starts on page 3, line 28. This is the disposition of property not needed in the conduct of a banking business. This removes the department's authority to set a time limit on the disposal of real and personal property. Instead, the carrying value and write-down will be dictated by generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP. Section 7, which starts on page 4, line 5, this amends ASO 605260. This change allows a state bank to pledge bank assets as collateral security to secure funds deposited by federally recognized tribes and consortiums of federally recognized tribes. And Mr. Chair, if any questions come up on these sections, I don't know how you want to handle this, but there are testifiers online from the Alaska Banking Association if there are any questions regarding these sections, if committee members have. But I'll continue. Section 8 starts on page 4, line 24. This adds a new subsection to ASO 605260. This new subsection replaces the Division of Banking's parity orders, the 12-B3-6, regarding the pledging of assets for interest rate swaps, and it adds a new subsection to define federally recognized tribe as an Indian tribe under the Federally Recognized Indian Tribe List Act of 1994, and it provides a definition for interest rate swap as a stream of future interest payments that are exchanged for another stream of future interest payments. Section 9 starts on page 5, line 9. This amends AS 0605355, subsection 8. This requires all banks to become a member of FDIC as a condition for receiving a certificate of authority.
And this I do have a question on this section.
Yes.
Mr. Burns or Representative LeBond, it seems like this change would be positive for consumers. Is that a correct understanding?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is that regarding FDIC insurance?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. It absolutely is a positive for depositors, be it consumers or businesses. Every depositor is going to look for FDIC insurance. So although it formalizes a requirement, it's standard practice.
Right. Representative Sponholz has a question, too.
Yeah, I have a question, actually, on Section 6. And in the sectional summary, it says that the value and write-down of assets will be dictated by a GAAP principles. I don't see anything specific in the statute that references that in the bill.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Sponholz, for that question. The requirement to write down an asset can be connected to one of two things. It can be just a timeline requirement, write down the asset. When I say write down an asset, if a bank forecloses on a piece of property and now holds it as other own real estate, that asset has a value. And before, statute said write down that value 20% every year for 5 years to zero, regardless of what its value might be. The value could be increasing over time. This allows for GAAP or standard accounting procedures to value the asset, and then the holding period reflects the value of the asset.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
So do you just want to, could you just clarify then, like, what is it that requires a bank to adhere to GAAP, just for the sort of public?
Yeah, it's just standard accounting procedures. Representative Schrage, you could probably talk at length about the definition of GAAP, but it provides a standard basis for valuation of an asset.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, Mike Martin with Northrim Bank may be able to provide further explanation for the committee.
Let's address that when we go to Mr. Martin's testimony and finish the sectional. And by the way, I should have noted Representative Kaufman was here right after we gaveled in, and I think I mentioned Representative Snyder had been getting online and is online.
Moving back to the sectional, Section 10, this repeals and reenacts AS 06-05-399. This starts page 5, line 14. And this section governs the changes of location of branch banks. This language provides state-chartered banks parity with credit unions when establishing a bank branch. Banks are currently subject to stricter bank branch application requirements under regulation. The division would establish in regulation similar requirements to that of credit unions, and you'll see this language repeated in Section 19 for state-chartered mutual banks. Moving on to Section 11, which amends AS 06-05-438, subsection A, starts on line 19. This reduces the number of required meetings of a bank's board from 10 to once quarterly. Section 12 amends AS 06-05-555, subsection A. This starts on line 23 with the change on line 28. This is conforming language to changes that were made in Section 10 to provide Alaska chartered banks parity with credit unions when establishing a bank branch. Section 13 amends AS 06-05-990, subsection 4. This is the definition section for this chapter. This excludes remote service unit from the definition of branch bank and then refines remote service unit directly. Section 14 starts on page 6, line 29. This repeals and reenacts AS 06-15-180. This chapter 15 of Title 6 governs mutual banks. These are state chartered mutual banks. This language allows mutual banks to have similar borrowing options as state banks. This raises the amount that may be borrowed from a mutual bank to no more than 15% of assets unless the department approves a greater amount, and this is being moved up from the current 5% limit. Section 15 amends AS 06-15-190. It starts on page 7, line 3. And this just expands the deposits that mutual banks can accept beyond just savings deposits. Section 16 amends AS 06-15-220. It starts on line 10. It allows trustees to delegate their authority to approve interest on deposits. Section 17 starts on line 15. This repeals and reenacts AS 06-15-240. This provides mutual banks with the same investment opportunities as state banks in Chapter 5, Section 270.
Question, sorry. Explain again the difference between a mutual bank and another type of bank.
Mr. Colchair, yes, the mutual bank is a non-stock institution. If you were to look at another community bank in Fairbanks, Denali State Bank, in comparison to my former employer, Mount McKinley Bank, Denali State Bank is a stock-owned institution. Mount McKinley Bank is a mutual institution. The depositors of Mount McKinley Bank are, quote, the owners of the bank, whereas there's investors, stockholders, that would own Denali State Bank in that example.
Got it. And follow-up to that, is it fair to say under this bill that consumer protections are the same regardless of the ownership structure?
Through the chair, yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, once again, Joe Burns, staff to Representative LeBon. Going on to Section 18, this starts on line 23 of page 7. This repeals and reenacts AS 06-15-250. This provides mutual banks with the same lending opportunities as state banks. Section 19 begins on line 28. This repeals and reenacts AS 06-15-290. This is in regards to changes of location and branch banks. This is similar to Section 10. It just provides mutual banks parity with state banks and credit unions when establishing a bank branch. Section 20 starts on page 8, line 2. This amends AS 4370105, subsection A. This is the Alaska Business License Act. This language exempts depository institutions, which are banks and credit unions, from the requirement to obtain business licenses for all headquarter and branch locations. Currently, state chartered institutions receive a certificate of authority through the Division of Banking and Securities. And until each institution receives a certificate, they may not transact business. So this would just eliminate that duplication, reducing that regulatory burden. Section 21 starts on line 25. This amends AS 4603-822. This is just conforming language. It makes a reference to subsection O, which is going to be added in section 22. Section 22, that starts on page 9, line 28, and continues on to page 10, line 20. This adds a new subsection to AS 4603-822. And what this does is it conforms state law to the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or CERCLA, standard for lender liability. Under CERCLA, there's a secured creditor exemption that eliminates owner or operator liability for lenders who hold ownership in a CERCLA facility primarily to protect their security interests in that facility, provided that the lender does not participate in the management of the facility. So generally, participation in the management applies if a bank exercises decision-making control over a property's environmental compliance or exercises control at a level similar to a manager of the property.
Thanks. And could you provide some examples of what these CERCLA properties might typically be in the state of Alaska? Are we talking about gas stations? Are there others?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The laws, environmental laws that banks have to operate under, need to align with federal chartered and state chartered banks, and we need to have the environmental rules for both types of banks be consistent. And beyond that, that's the gist of this section. And then as far as operating a property, if a bank forecloses on a property, It is very rare for a bank to then engage in operating a business, use a filling station or gas station as an example, and I think I use that with many of the committee members in visiting your offices. You won't see a bank doing that for several reasons, and one of the big ones is once you take up operation and management of a business, then you're exposing yourself to potential environmental risk as an operator and a manager of a business. So that's not likely to occur in a normal course of business for a bank.
Got it. What are some other properties that might not be controlled by a bank, but which could potentially be foreclosed on, would be affected by this section? Just typically, is that like dry cleaners, or what are the range of properties we're looking at?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, any property that a bank acquires through a foreclosure action, after that action, even in some cases before conclusion of that action, there's an effort to evaluate the environmental risk associated with that property, be it a gas station, a dry cleaners, or even a residential property. A bank will do a level of due diligence, which may include a phase one environmental study to include a soils test, a drill sample, to determine what the environmental contamination may be with that property. Because once the property is owned by a bank, then there's an obligation to know what the environmental risk is, because eventually they're going to sell that property to a new owner.
Got it. Thank you.
Continuing on, Mr. Chair, just to finish up some of the explanation on that section 22. As Representative LeBon indicated, that secure creditor exemption in CERCLA, it provides that foreclosure on our property does not result in liability for a bank, provided the bank takes reasonable steps to divest itself of the property at the earliest practicable commercially reasonable time on commercially reasonable terms. Moving on to Section 23. This starts on page 10, line 21. These are repealed sections. The first one is AS 0605-265. This is regarding the liability of directors for certain losses. AS 06-10-010 through Section 50. This is the Model Foreign Bank Loan Act, AS 06-15-150, and then sections 160 and 170. These are surplus requirements, additions, and limitations. And then the last section being repealed is AS 06-15-230, regarding withdrawal of deposits. Section 24, these are annulled regulations. This starts page 10, line 23. The first one is Title 3 of the Alaska Administrative Code, Chapter 2, Section 121. These are credit card for officers. This relates back to Sections 2 and 5. And the second one is Title 3, Section 2, sorry, Title 3, Chapter 2, Section 135. This is disposition of property not needed for banking business, also relating to Section 2 and then also Section 6. And then Section 25, this is applicability language added to and codified law. Section 26 is transition language. Hmm. Section 27 is delayed effective date. And then Section 28 is the immediate effective date.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. I guess I do have a question maybe for follow-up next time, or it could be in writing or whatever is convenient. But in downtown, there are many properties with plumes of pollution, often from dry cleaners. And I guess one thing I'm trying to understand is what's the best regulatory structure where obviously we want investment, we want redevelopment, we want kind of the maximum remediation that's economically possible, but we don't want overly strict, I don't want overly strict remediation laws that actually inhibit development. You know, this bill is obviously not primarily about that, but I guess I would like to understand the landscape as it affects districts like mine, and I don't know the best person to come in and comment on that, or maybe Mike Martin wants to talk about that in his testimony, but that's one question I have in my district.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Martin would be an excellent individual to answer that question.
Well, sounds good. Let's go to invited testimony. Mike Martin, if you're online, please proceed.
Thank you. Co-chairs and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Michael Martin, and I am the Chief Operating Officer and General Counsel of North Rim Bank. I'm also the President of the Alaska Bankers Association, and thank you very, very much for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 85. North Rim Bank is a state of Alaska chartered community bank, started in Anchorage in 1990. North Rim Bank currently operates 17 branches throughout Alaska, located in Anchorage, the Matanuska Valley, Soldotna, Juneau, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Sitka. And we recently opened a loan production office in Kodiak and a second branch in Fairbanks. North Rim serves the banking needs of approximately 90% of Alaska's population. The Alaska Bankers Association represents the seven banks that have operations in Alaska. This includes the four Alaska chartered banks, Denali State Bank, Mount McKinley Bank, First Bank Ketchikan, and North Rim Bank, and three national banks chartered by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Key Bank, Wells Fargo, and First National Bank Alaska. Alaska banks safeguard over $14 billion in combined deposits in Alaska and employ more than 2,200 proud professionals across 121 branches statewide. Those employees have served Alaskans as essential workers during the pandemic. Alaska banks are responsible for over 85% of non-public commercial lending in Alaska. The members of the Alaska Bankers Association are job creators, fueling Alaska's economy by providing credit businesses and families need to grow. Alaska banks stepped up in a major way in 2020 and 2021 by lending over $1.4 billion to help make the Federal Paycheck Protection Program a success. Alaska Bankers Association's PPP loans provide vital financial lifelines to many small business linked to 90,000 jobs statewide. Alaska's banks are committed to supporting communities, businesses, and individuals that help build a prosperous future in Alaska. All seven banks, both the Alaska Chartered and Federally Chartered, support House Bill 85. The Alaska Bankers Association along with the four Alaska chartered banks, have submitted letters of support for House Bill 85, which are published in the bill packet. The Alaska Bankers Association has worked in concert with the State of Alaska Division of Banking and Securities to develop this proposed legislation. The provisions of House Bill 85 provide for meaningful updates to the banking code that were crafted by both Alaska banks and the regulators who oversee them. We are grateful to Representative LeBon and his staff for sponsoring this bill, which has come together thanks to his efforts and the efforts of the State of Alaska Division of Banking and Security. This bill is essential to better serve our Alaskan customers, expand banking products and services throughout the state of Alaska, keep Alaska chartered banks competitive with other financial institutions, create parity between laws and regulations which govern the various types of financial institutions that operate in the state, keep pace with technological advances in banking, enable efficiency of operations, ensure the safety and soundness of banks, and protect businesses and consumers of Alaska. We support House Bill 85 to reflect changes in technology, consumer preference, and the business of banking. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thanks, Mr. Martin. Next up in invited testimony is David Durham of Mount McKinley Bank. Mr. Durham, please proceed.
Hi, good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members, and a special hello to my former boss and friend, Bart LeBon. I, too, thank you for carrying HB 85 for the Alaska Bankers Association and the Division of Banking. My name is David Durham. I am the Chief Credit Administrator and Executive Vice President of Mount McKinley Bank, and I currently serve as the Secretary Treasurer of the Alaska Bankers Association. Mount McKinley Bank is unusual, as Representative LeBon had mentioned, that we are owned by our depositors, and that gives us a special focus in our community. We serve the North Star Borough and the surrounding road communities. The monies that we generate in profits are held in the bank, and they are benefiting our customers, our depositors, through lower deposit rates and interest on loans. We have a very strong community focus, and we continue to donate a great sum of money into our community to help support it. Mount McKinley Bank is unique. We're of a handful of mutual banks on the West Coast. Most mutual banks are located back east. We have strong support for HB 85, especially the sections that deal with mutual banks. These regulations have not been updated in a while, and with the deregulation of savings and loans, some of these areas have become a hindrance to our business and our ability to serve our customers. We believe that HB 85 allows us to remain competitive, to be able to continue to offer our customers the best service that they require, and allows us that parity with our fellow Alaska bankers and the national banks. I'd also like to make a comment about the CERCLA regulations that we are proposing and just kind of offer us some testimony on that. A couple years ago, we had to foreclose on a gas station in a rural community that would be Delta Junction. We were advised by two attorneys not to touch title. There were some environmental actions on that property. This property had gone through remediation. I had actually lent the money to the former owners in 1998 to do the remediation. But there were some covenants and some notices that were carried along with the property. And in the end, we were not allowed, we could not foreclose on the property due to our attorney's advice. We had to find somebody that was willing to bid on the property at auction and take title to it, which basically caused Mount McKinley Bank to suffer a fairly substantial loss. And so that is one of the reasons why we have proposed the CERCLA laws for the state. We had always been under the impression that the federal law would speak if state law was silent, but that was not the case. And so we're seeking to have those CERCLA protections to protect lenders because we do make investment in our Alaskan communities that help them to grow and to help keep essential goods and services in those communities. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thanks, Mr. Durham. And I should have mentioned, if you and Mr. Martin happen to write down your testimony, feel free to email it to us. Ms. Reno with the Division of Banking Securities, did you want to offer testimony, or are you just available for questions?
Yes, I have testimony.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Reno. Please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tracy Reno, and I am a financial examiner for and a chief of examinations with the Division of Banking and Securities. The Division of Banking and Securities serves as the primary regulator for four state-chartered banks in Alaska. These banks follow the Alaska banking statutes, which have become outdated over time. The nationally chartered banks have had the advantage of broader powers from updated federal laws, creating disparity between two banking systems. There has been a collaborative effort between the Alaska Bankers Association and the Division of Banking and Securities to bridge the gap between the state and federal law. HB 85 modernizes and streamlines Alaska's banking law to bring parity between the state and national banks and level the playing field. HB 85 will help our state banks to be competitive with modern best practices and the evolution of financial services that they provide. The administration has not yet taken a position on this legislation. However, the bill does align with the governor's priorities by reducing regulatory burden and modernizing Alaska law. We anticipate the administration will be supportive of the bill after the changes are made to address the Department of Environmental Conservation's concerns, which they are currently discussing with the bill sponsor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Reno. And at this time, committee members can ask questions of any of the invited testifiers or the bill sponsor. First up is Representative Snyder. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Chair Fields. I have three different questions on slightly different aspects of the bill. Would you like me to do one and then get back in the queue?
Just go ahead and proceed with your questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative LeBond. It was great to chat with you yesterday. I appreciated the opportunity to ask some questions and spend a little time, additional time looking at the bill, and it's mostly coming together for me. I did want to ask, I've heard, and I know in the sponsor statement, it talks a lot about one of the primary goals is to modernize and streamline and bring parity between the state chartered and national banks. Is there anywhere, or could you provide a crosswalk for someone such as myself who is orienting themselves to those national guidelines, maybe for the first time, to have an understanding of, to see how that parity is being met, so what the national standards are and what we're achieving here in this bill? Or might I find a crosswalk somewhere already?
Yes, thank you, Representative Snyder, for the question. And if I may, Mr. Co-Chair, if either of our invited experts would like to answer, I would love their participation.
Okay, please jump in, Mr. Martin or Durham or Ms. Reno.
Yes, this is Michael Martin.
Go ahead, Mr. Martin.
Thank you. So a good example of that would be the question that Representative Sponholz asked concerning the write-down of assets, also known as OREO or other real estate owned. So those assets find their way onto the bank's balance sheet when there's a foreclosure and there's a general obligation to not hold the property, but to pass it on to get it off of the books of the bank. And so, for instance, the current statute provides for a layered or laddered write-down of the asset. And I don't know this, but I've always assumed that the intention behind that was so that banks don't hold assets and that they move them off their books. So that provision is not required of national banks. They simply follow general accounting principles, as do all of the state banks as well. And so that does cause us to, when we find ourselves in a situation where we have a piece of real estate, but the market is such that we can't find a willing buyer to take it,
we're required to either write it down or to make application to the division for a waiver of that requirement while we continue to market the property. So in my mind, that's at least a very real issue that has come up from time to time. Thank you.
Other questions?
Go ahead,
Representative Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that example, but I think with my question, so an example, I guess I'm looking for a summary of these specific things that we're finding parity with, if that was something that could be supplied after the meeting to continue wrapping my head around that, that would be very appreciated. The next question has to do with our discussion around CERCLA, and so what that was sections 22, am I right? Yes, and 21 backing up. And I know we kept mentioning CERCLA and Superfund sites, but am I correct in assuming that those sections aren't necessarily limited to CERCLA and resulting otherwise known as Superfund and those sites? We'd be talking about other environmental contaminated sites that were not necessarily designated as Superfund sites. Is that correct?
Yes, I would invite either Mr. Chairman, with your consent, either Mr. Durham or Mr. Martin, if you'd like to take a stab, or I will. It's up to you, gentlemen.
This is David Durham. Yes, I'd be happy to answer that, Chairman, for Chairman. It does not necessarily, a property doesn't have to be a Superfund site or a brownfield site. It just could be a property that has had some type of environmental action on it from the state, and so it just basically allows us to be able to take those properties back and market them without taking on the liability to remediate these properties.
This is Michael Martin. I'd like an opportunity to comment on that as well.
Please.
Yeah, so, I think there's a general misunderstanding of how this law particularly works. So when banks are making a loan and the borrower is providing collateral for that loan, if it's a piece of real estate, you know, banks do an environmental assessment of the property, phase one or phase two, depending upon the nature of the property. And the rationale behind a bank taking that step isn't necessarily the fear associated with somehow being liable for the cleanup, the cost of the cleanup of remediating the property. It has more to do with the notion that if there is contamination on the property, that would affect the value of the collateral. And so the general premise under CERCLA is that if a financial institution is taking a piece of real estate as collateral for a loan, unless they go in and actually operate the business, there would be no liability. And I'm not an environmental law expert, but the general notion is that once there is a contamination discovered on the property, that all folks who are in the chain of title are responsible for the cleanup, and then there's the general there's an allocation of who is responsible for the actual contamination and how it goes about being cleaned up. And so financial institutions generally have the sense that as long as they're just taking the collateral for purposes of security of a loan, that there won't be any liability. And the risk associated with that is that somehow the collateral is devalued or perhaps even has no value because the cost of remediation is greater than the cost of the property itself. Those are my comments. Thank you very much.
I think Representative Sponholz has a couple questions, and then I think we're going to have to move on to confirmations, and we will certainly return to this bill for more questions. And I actually like the idea of a kind of a written crosswalk. I don't know if that's easily doable by the bill sponsor, the Bankers Association, but that would help me too, Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, I'd love to see that crosswalk as well, just so we can make sure we understand what we're doing here. I actually had a question for Tracy Reno with the Division of Banking Securities. You said that there were a couple of issues that you were working with the bill sponsor on. What are those issues?
Through the co-chair, Sternholz, this is Tracy Reno. We are not working with the bill sponsors. We are satisfied at this moment with our language or the language of the bill that represents of the Act 06. The thing that I referenced was Section 21 and 22, which is the CERCLA and the DEC. They are working with the Bankers Association to get that language right.
All right, thank you. And then maybe I guess my question then would go to the Division Department of Environmental Conservation. I think we have Tiffany Larson on. Ms. Larson, are you there?
I am, yes.
All right, so same question to you. What there's an issue that you're working with the bill sponsor on. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we understand that the Alaska Bankers Association would like to include CERCLA language in the state law, and we appreciate Representative LeBond's reference to consistency between the state and federal language. And the Alaska Bankers Association has been very open to our concerns about the differences between what's in the bill and what's in CERCLA, and we've had some positive conversations there. So the I guess that's what I have to say.
I have a question on that, just logistically. Ms. Larson, or perhaps the bill sponsor, what's your estimated time frame on coming to consensus on that, just for planning purposes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have the estimated time frame unless one of our experts on the line can answer that question.
Okay, that's okay. We can play it by ear. Representative Kaufman has a question, and I think we need to move on to confirmations, unfortunately.
Thank you. Through the chair, not a question, just want to say thank you, Representative LeBond and Mr. Burns, for the great job you did previewing this, answering all the questions. I appreciate that, especially on a bill like this that has some technicality to it. So greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. I think let's set an amendment deadline for Tuesday at noon. If there are unresolved issues, we can address them next week. Thanks, Representative LeBond. And Mr. Burns, Mr. Martin, Mr. Durham, and Ms. Reno, and Ms. Larson for providing testimony and answering questions. At this time, we need to move on to confirmations. So we're actually going to go out of order a little bit to start with the Board of Social Work Examiners. I'm hoping that Mindy Swisher is available. Ms. Swisher, are you available to offer your testimony? And for all these confirmations, please aim for 1 minute of testimony because we have an hour before we have to go to a meeting. I want to get through as many of these as we can in fairness to you all. So, Ms. Swisher, please proceed.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, my name is Mindy Swisher. I live in Palmer, Alaska. I've been serving on the board for the last 2 years. I am a clinical social worker. I work for the Office of Children's Services as a regional manager. One of the things I like about being on the board is that I'm able to serve Alaska in a different way. I believe it's vital that we protect the public and make sure that all social workers are following statutes and regulations. So thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you. Do members have questions for Ms. Swisher? Representative Sponholz.
All right, Ms. Swisher. So I understand that until recently you were also a member of the Resource Families Advisory Board. Are you foster parents as well?
No, I'm not. I did serve on that board for 2 years as an OCS representative, and it was a great experience as well.
All right, thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, Ms. Swisher, thanks for being here today. Moving on to John Cox. Mr. Cox, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me?
Great. And Mr. Cox, you don't need to do an opening statement because you did last time, but thank you for returning for some questions. And I have some questions related to public health and Title IV. Mr. Cox, what do you see as your role on the ABC board as a public member?
It's basically to provide safety for the state of Alaska, its citizens, and to protect the state from lawsuits.
Okay. What experience do you have in working with Title IV and AMCO?
I served as the commanding officer for the VFW here in Anchor Point, where I dealt with the sales and the education of alcohol and distribution for the facility.
Representative Sponholz.
I oversaw the sales of and the daily operation of the club itself.
Got it. Thank you. Going to Representative Sponholz.
All right, Mr. Cox, I just want to follow up on something that you just said. You said one of the roles that you saw yourself serving was protecting the state of Alaska from lawsuits, and the board's function is defined as controlling the manufacture, barter, possession, and sale of alcohol beverages in the state of Alaska. How do you see yourself protecting the state of Alaska from lawsuits?
Well, I answered this a question similar to this last time it was on, and one of the issues that I found that needs to be addressed would be the resale of a license. And when it comes to a license, based on Title 4, Section 411.660, it talks about the license, and it specifically states that a license issued under this title is a privilege and not a property right. And when we talk about protecting the state of Alaska and individuals, if I no longer wish to participate in a sale of a alcoholic beverages, then that license should be returned back to the state based on the way Title IV is written. And to protect, also continue on to protect the state of Alaska, it also discourages monopolizing of these licenses as well.
Follow up?
Yes.
So are you aware of any lawsuits that are being filed against the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board or the state of Alaska?
No, we're going to be addressing these issues at our next meeting. I have not had a chance to look at Senate Bill 9, which will be addressing several issues on the on Title IV, I believe. And some of these things we're just trying to prevent to help protect the state. There are people out there that will file lawsuits at the drop of a hat, and you know, we want to try and head it off before it gets out of control.
All right.
Let's go to Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, last time that was brought up as intriguing thought, and actually I talked to several restaurants and bars in my district asking about this issue here, and it was quite revealing that the restaurants, and I don't know the terminology, but that had wine and beer is different than the liquor, and this is referring to the bars that have the full liquor privilege license like that, that what I discovered from the restaurants is, yes, they sell that at a high rate, or whatever the rate, but the liquor stores or the restaurants only have wine and beer. They do not have that privilege. Is that your understanding too, Mr. Cox?
I'm sorry. You're wearing a mask. I can't understand what you're saying through the phone.
Yeah, we're all wearing masks, so...
Mr. Cox, the question was, do you want to talk about the different types of licenses?
It sounds muffled to me.
You can repeat it, I guess.
It's about the after-sale market.
They can get closer to the mic.
Yeah. So, can you hear me now?
A little bit better, yes.
All right. So the question is, it's like I see that there's different types of licenses, one for the restaurants that have a wine and beer license compared to a full-on bar that... It appears they have that piece that you're expressing, being able to sell their license on their own for whatever high price, whereas the restaurant who has a wine and beer license cannot do that. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. And this is what you're sharing concern that someone may file as a proactive thing. You're thinking that to deal with this so that someone's not filing lawsuits against the state because it's not fair in the sense
correct.
Okay.
You know, and like I said, it based on Title 4, 4.11.690, where it specifically talks about preventing monopolies here in the state. And what we're doing is, currently what we're doing is we're allowing that type of procedure to happen.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Cox, I think last time you mentioned that you owned a tobacco shop, which also has strict rules about not selling to minors. Can you talk about the steps that you had as a business owner to prevent sales to minors, and how does this inform your view on preventing sale of alcohol to minors?
Well, what's happened is I no longer own that business. I made enough money to purchase the building that I have, that I was operating out of, and now I rent it out. There are a lot of strict guidelines that you have to follow to ensure compliance with state regulations, ID, sales, all of those type of issues. And, I feel that there are times that an employee may make a mistake, and it can be pretty harsh on the owner of the business. Or there were a couple times where I had a minor come in, and my employee accidentally made a mistake and sold tobacco to him. We faced a fine, and of course, it was a little upsetting about it. Those are just hurdles that you have to learn to deal with, and I don't believe that the owners of the business should be fined. I believe that the employee should take the brunt of the fine itself.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Cox. You had mentioned that you your involvement with the VFW. Are you still on that board of the club that owns the liquor license?
I was a member of the, as I served as the commander. Then after that term, I served as a trustee. And when I was approached to serve on the ABC board, I resigned from the position of a trustee, where I oversaw the books and the finances of the facility.
Got it. Thank you. I think last time you talked about permits and maybe referenced the fishing industry. Do you see alcohol licenses as needing to be treated differently than limited entry fishing permits?
I don't recall making a statement about a fishing industry or anything.
Oh.
I know we are talking about right now on the board about allowing charters to purchase a license for sales on board charter boats.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. Representative Spahnholz.
Yeah. When you testified in committee last week, you described the problem with the after sale market of liquor licenses and felt that this was sort of an unfair thing. And I asked you if you had any solution to the problem, because many businesses across the state. One of my father owned a bar with a liquor license, and he paid a lot of money for that license. And when he sold the business, he was able to then recoup that investment upon sale. I asked you if you had any ideas about how to resolve that significant financial issue, and I'm wondering if you had a chance to think further about that.
I do, and because we've made mistakes in the allowing of the process of an individual purchasing a license and then turning around and selling it, because it is a privilege, not a property, and because this practice has gone on for so long, I believe now that what we need to do is, let's just say for an example, your father has a business. He purchased that license at an exorbitant amount of money. To recoup his money, he may turn around and sell it to the next person. But the next person buying it has to understand that once they assume possession of that license, if they now want to turn around and sell it, they may not. It is an investment that they will be making. If they know the second person no longer wishes to participate after they bought that license from your father, then that license would go back to the state, like it should, because a license is a permission from the state to participate in commerce. That license then go up in a form of a lottery to make it fair for any and everybody in the state that wishes to participate in that license.
So it's your position then that the people that have made that investment should just basically have to eat it because you don't support the underlying system?
The people that have already purchased, made that investment, it's my opinion that they should be able to sell it as they see fit. However, the caveat to that is that the purchaser understands that if they no longer wish to participate in that newly acquired license, that license would wind up going to the state. They would no longer be able to turn around and sell it.
It still strikes me that somebody's going to get hurt in that process. And if there were a way to transition that would hold, you know, that would manage that sort of sunk cost issue, then it might be easier to solve this aftermarket issue that you've identified, which has been really controversial. And, you know, Senate Bill 9 that you've mentioned, it's been introduced multiple times over multiple years, and we haven't been able to resolve it because it is such a politically contentious issue. So I have a question. So are you're comfortable then with maintaining sort of the limited entry system that we have for alcohol, because alcohol is contributes to poor public health in the state of Alaska?
I am right now, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Cox. Let's get one more question from.
And that's one of the main purposes of having this board, is to sit and discuss issues to see if we can correct and solve some of the problems that Alaskans are facing.
Thanks, Mr. Cox. Let's get one more question from Representative Kaufman, and then we'll need to move on to other appointees. And by the way, thank you for coming back for more questions. Obviously, an important board. Representative Kaufman.
Hopefully, this is the last one.
Thank you. And through the chair, not so much a question, just a comment. This is really an interesting topic. And as I'm listening, I started imagining, what if the case was there was a finite amount of driver's licenses, and those had a cash value because it was a limited permit that we were then it's just an interesting concept to consider. But I do think what was being described as a way where the party that buys the license knows that that's finite, that's the last time it's transferable. And the interesting thing, the output of that would be that there would start to become a population of like new licenses returning to the state. So it once it got up and running, it might have merit. I'm just thankful for the conversation. It's interesting to contemplate.
One of the other things, can I make a statement real quick? One of the other issues that we have is, like, right now here on the Kenai Peninsula, there are, allotted only 11 package store licenses. Currently, there are 17 licenses out there. See, so that'll help correct that problem that the state currently has.
Okay. Representative Shiragi had a question, and then we'll move on to the other appointees.
Yeah, I actually just want to make a short comment, and through the chair, thank you for your indulgence. Just, I think you have to recognize that when you put a condition on a license that you can sell it once, but then that next person is not able to sell it, they have to give it back to the state, that will greatly diminish the value of their investment. So either way, there is a party being harmed, whether it's the person who originally invested or otherwise, you're greatly reducing the value of that. The only way that you are going to preserve the purchaser, the person that made that investment, the only way that you are going to preserve their wealth is if the state buys it back. And quite frankly, I don't know how the state would do that given our financial situation. Just a comment that that solution is not a solution. It still hurts the person who made that investment.
Yep. Well, Mr. Cox, thanks again for coming back before the committee. Really appreciate it. We're next going to go to the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. Patty Burley, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I am online. Thank you.
So again, let's aim for 1 minute per testifier. Please proceed.
Hi, I'm Patty Burley. I lived in Bethel for 19 years and recently moved to the Kenai Peninsula. I am hoping that you will consider me for the Labor Relations Board. I'm hoping to bring a lot of Bush perspective to it and a lot of years of sort of looking at both sides of the table, the employee and the employer. And hopefully that's brief enough for you.
Okay. Do members have questions for Ms. Burley?
No question.
Representative Sponholz.
Ms. Burley, which category of position are you holding, a management, labor, or general public position?
Management.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no additional questions, Dennis DeWitt, are you online? If so, please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Denny DeWitt. Can you hear me?
Maybe try to be closer to the phone. It's just a little distant, but go ahead.
I'll try and speak up. I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm honored to be the governor's appointment to the Alaska Labor Relations Board. I've worked in and around government my entire career. I was the director of the Division of Pioneer Benefits. I've been a special assistant to Governor Murkowski, where I was working with the Department of Administration. During those times, I've worked with the labor relations activities. I also served as staff to the House Finance Committee, where I also worked with labor relations issues. I believe my background prepares me well for the responsibilities of a member of the Alaska Labor Relations Board. My responsibilities include the ability to listen, review pertinent statutes and previous board decisions, and do my best to render fair decisions. Thank you for your consideration.
Thanks, Mr. DeWitt. Questions for Mr. DeWitt? I'll ask the same one. Which category of seat are you being appointed to, Mr. DeWitt?
Public.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, next up, Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, Mr. DeWitt, thanks for taking time to come and testify before the committee today. What is it that you're hoping to do with your time on the Labor Relations Board?
Be a good arbiter of
Mr. DeWitt, can you lean into the microphone just a little bit more? We can barely hear you.
I'm sorry.
There we go.
I hope to be a good arbiter of folks who have differences of opinion on issues that are before us.
I'm not going to follow up right now.
Okay. Seeing no additional questions, thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Justin Mack, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
I am here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, through the chair, my name is Justin Mack. First, I'd like to say thank you for your consideration for the appointment to the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, as for a labor seat. I was born and raised in Alaska, honored to serve the city of Anchorage as a captain with the Anchorage Fire Department. I have a wife, two-year-old daughter, and a new baby due in May. I currently serve as an executive board member of the Anchorage Firefighters Union and the vice president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. During this time, I've had an inside look at the importance of finding common ground between employees and employers. I have experience serving the state. I was on the workers' comp board for the past 3 years, and I look forward to serving in this new role.
Questions for Mr. Mack? Not seeing any. Thank you for being here. We're now going to move on to the Board of Public Accountancy. Rachel Hanks, please proceed with your testimony.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So to start off, my name is Rachel Hanks, and I've lived in the Fairbanks area for over 32 years now, and I've served on several nonprofit boards because I love being able to give back to the community that I've lived in for so long. I've been a public accountant specializing in tax for almost 20 years, and have worked directly with the IRS for 10 years as an enrolled agent. I've had my license for almost 2 years, which kind of makes for a unique situation because usually people have their license for considerably longer to get on the board. So it allows me to be rather current on the regulations regarding like the eligibility set for the exam, the structure of the exam, like the testing environment, as well as the requirements for licensing. And an issue I'm interested in working with is the peer review expansion that is currently being discussed on the board.
Okay. Any question for Ms. Hanks? Seeing no questions, thanks, Ms. Hanks. Lance Johnson, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I am online. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Lance Johnson. I originally moved to Alaska in 2012 to work with Denali Federal Alaskans as their chief auditor, internal auditor. So that was a position I held until their merger with New Vision Credit Union. Currently, I work with USAA, that's United Services Automobile Association, as a risk management professional. And my role there, I'm a remote employee that's based here in Alaska. And some other examples of the experience that I have is I was worked as an independent consultant providing professional education decision management services for several regional and global financial service organizations. I worked in internal audit, which is different than the public accounting space, but I worked in internal audit and risk management for over 25 years, holding various executive management positions in internal audit and risk management. Although I'm not a CPA, I do hold other professional designations relating to the profession of internal audit and IT audit and risk management, and would be happy to answer any of those questions about that if there are any. But my interest or my reason for wanting to serve on the board is I work with a lot of public accountants in my years in my role as an internal audit, relied on their work both as from a consulting standpoint where they provided services, but also worked closely with them when they performed the external audits of the firms that I worked with. And so I have an interest in ensuring the integrity of the work that they do. But being able to take it as a perspective, not as a CPA, but as a professional that uses their work as well as they rely on the work that I do internally for some of the things. So it's kind of a balance in between that. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my insights and hope that I can be a value to the board.
Thanks, Mr. Johnson. Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Johnson, I see on your resume it has you at Institute of Internal Auditors, Lake Mary, Florida, through the present. Is that what you were saying with it? It goes to remote working, or can you expand on that a little bit?
No. My role with the Institute of Internal Auditors is I have served in a volunteer capacity with them over probably about a dozen years, primarily as a facilitator for the training work that they provide for professional internal auditors and risk professionals. But I've also served on a volunteer basis in helping draft some of the guidance and directions that they've been involved in a couple of their publication teams that have developed standards for those professions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm not seeing additional questions. Oh, Representative Bonholz.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, thanks for coming before the committee today. I don't have your application. I just have a resume, and it looks like that you are you're affiliated with, I guess that's the Institute of Internal Auditors that Representative Nelson was just describing. Do you, in fact, reside in the state of Alaska?
Yes, I do. I reside in Anchorage itself.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Mr. Johnson, for being here. Stephen Jordan, if you're online, please proceed with your testimony. Stephen Jordan doesn't appear to be online. We'll see if we can reschedule. Donald Vieira, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Donald Vieira. I've been a resident out here in Palmer since 2001. I've been serving on the Board of Public Accountancy for the past year already, and then we were going through the confirmation process when COVID hit and kind of put everything on hold. But been serving on the board for that year, covering everything from new applications to international applications and various regulations that we've been looking at and examining. So the experience is building rapidly. It's a good experience so far. I'm pretty happy with that. I was a CPA in Anchorage for a number of years, working as an auditor previously, and then decided to open my own small firm out here in Valley, and have been doing that ever since. And I appreciate your consideration today.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Vieira, I see First off, that you're a Rotarian, and as a fellow Rotarian, I want to congratulate you on that. You have a few more years than I do, but we can talk about that later. I wanted to make note, though, of your 23.5-year service in the United States Air Force. Is that what initially brought you up here, was a PCS, or can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I was my PCS'd actually up to Fairbanks back in 1989 and spent 3 years up there, and then finally got back to the state in 2001, and yeah, it was a PCS move that brought us back up here.
Following. So yeah, you could say that it's a great state to be at, and you decided to come back after all these years?
Absolutely. In fact, we were just getting to Fairbanks and hadn't even gone through our first winter, and we already knew that this is where we wanted to be.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you, and thank you for your service. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks to testifiers. We're moving on to the Workers' Compensation Board. Is Michael Dennis online, and if so, please proceed with your testimony.
This is Michael Dennis. I'm an insurance broker and a partner in Conrad House Insurance in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been a resident of Alaska since 1972 and been in the insurance business for 30 years, specialized in workman's compensation, just feel like I want to be on the board to help give some real-life experience to the problems and things that we have going on in Alaska.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Dennis? Not Representative Sponholz.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dennis, for coming before the committee today. Are you going into one of the industry slots or into a labor slot?
Industry slot, I believe.
All right. Thank you.
Anthony Ladd, if you're online, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you to the co-chair Fields and co-chair Sponholz and committee members. I appreciate your time and consideration for the position of board member for the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. I am a lifelong Alaskan, born and raised in Fairbanks, and I currently live in Anchorage with my wife and 2 children. I am the business manager for the Ironworkers Local 751 Alaska, and I currently sit on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board as the chair for the Assessment Evaluation Committee. I've sat in on the 2 workers' comp board meetings as well as participated as an observer on 2 cases since learning of my nomination for the board. I fully understand the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board is a real working board and look forward to the challenge upon your approval and confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ladd. Questions for Mr. Ladd? Not seeing any. Next up, I believe, is Jason Motika. Mr. Motika, are you online?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Please proceed.
All right. I'd like to thank you for the consideration of this nomination. A little bit about myself. I grew up here in Anchorage, Alaska, a lifelong Alaskan. I went to college in Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, where I got a business administration degree. I came back to Alaska when I was 25 and started my first business up in Denali National Park with 17 employees. And here 15 years later, we have multiple companies. Probably the most familiar to the board would be the 49th State Brewing Company here in Anchorage, Alaska, and we employed pre-COVID over 500 employees. And I'm interested in being a part of this board because of the complexities I've learned as being a business owner related to insurance and how the insurance regulations is actually distilled down to the business owners. Having seen both sides, not only the business owner side, but also representing employees that were my own employees going through the process, I realize that there's a lot of work that can be done to help this process and to hopefully lower the costs for employers, as well as providing the benefits that are needed for employees in this complicated system. So I appreciate the consideration, and thanks for your service to Alaska.
Well, thanks for investing in my district and creating a bunch of jobs there. I don't see any questions from committee members, so we're going to go on to the next testifier. Apologize. Nancy Shaw. Ms. Shaw, are you online?
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Shaw. I was appointed to the Workers' Compensation Board in December 2017. My initial appointment was to finish out the term of a board member that resigned, and that came to about 2 years. Then I was reappointed by the governor, and this would be, if you confirm me, my first full 3-year term. I was the attorney for the Teamsters Union for 15 years until 2016, and I worked for the union for 3 years at an earlier stage in my career. Obviously, I would be on the labor side of the house on this board. The union does not represent members in workers' compensation cases, and I did not represent workers in workers' compensation cases. But the daily work of the union has much to do with worker safety, safety protocols, worker and employer compliance with rules and methods designed to avoid worker injuries. So the bread and butter of the Workers' Compensation Board is certainly familiar, something dear to my heart. The work that I have done on the board, I think, fairly well dovetails with the work that I did as a union representative.
Thanks, Ms. Shaw. Any questions for Ms. Shaw? Not seeing any. Next up, we have our former colleague, Dave Tallarico. Mr. Tallarico, are you online? Looks like maybe Mr. Tallarico is not online, so we'll try to reschedule him for next week. Moving on to Robert Wheel. Mr. Wheel, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Robert Wheel. I have lived in the state of Alaska since my father took a wrong turn out of Tucson, Arizona in 1957, and have enjoyed living here, working here, and, of course, going to school here. I serve as a member at large on the industry side of the Workers' Compensation Board, and was initially accepted onto the board back when Governor Frank Murkowski was our governor 15 years ago. I do enjoy the job. I enjoy, trying to do my best to keep my mind and eyes set on both the employee and the employer as it pertains to workers' comp injuries, and feel very good about it and the job that I've done, and would love to participate for another 3 years if you feel like approving my appointment. Thank you to the members.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Wheel? Not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Wheel, for being here. At this time, Lake Williams, are you online?
Thank you. My name is Lake Williams. I'm born and raised in Fairbanks. I did leave for a little while to get a degree at the University of Iowa in business administration. I also was accepted into the operating engineer's apprenticeship in 96, and I completed that under Commissioner Click Bishop, or Senator Click Bishop. I've been on the board since 2014. I was initially appointed by Governor Parnell and accepted, and then reappointed by Governor Walker, and now again by Governor Dunleavy. If you choose to have me continue to serve, I do appreciate being on the board. It is a board that has, as they say, working, and has a lot of meeting to employers and employees, and I am always open to improving the system, and I think there is room for improvement, and I think, you know, the positions working for a union, you work with employers and workers and try to solve problems, and I think that brings something to this board, and I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Williams. Are there questions from committee members? Not seeing any. Thanks for testifying. Next, we're going to go on to the Midwives Board. Tanya Kirk, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony. Not seeing Ms. Kirk, we will next hear from the Board of Chiropractors. Mr. Kennedy, are you online?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Please proceed with your testimony.
Hello, this is my name is Dr. Tim Kennedy. I'd like to thank you guys for the opportunity to talk with you today. I've lived in Alaska for 49 years. I graduated from Diamond High School in 1977. I married my wife 34 years ago. I've raised two children and have a granddaughter and one more on the way. I've been a chiropractor for
38 years, have had served in numerous capacities, the Alaska State Chiropractic Society's president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer. I was president for my college alumni association, and I've been voted the chiropractor of the year here by my peers. I've served on various state and governor panels and boards. I see my service on this board as one to serve and protect the people of the state of Alaska. My entire career has consisted of treating patients the way I would like to be treated. As an avid outdoorsman, I am an advocate for Alaska's people, culture, and future. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Kennedy. Are there questions for Mr. Kennedy? Not seeing any. Next up for the Board of Chiropractic Examiners is John Lloyd. Mr. Lloyd, if you're online, please proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is John Lloyd. I'm a doctor of chiropractic. I've been a doctor of chiropractic for 22 years. Graduated from Gonzaga University back when Gonzaga wasn't known. The name was aptly misspelled. And as this weekend was evidence, that basketball team's come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I went to chiropractic school after that. It's been here in Alaska for many years, and have decided to work on or asked to be appointed to the board to help with the advancement of chiropractic throughout the state. Have been on the board for the last year. In that time, we've worked on essentially keeping offices open while being very cognizant and aware of public safety. I think that was a massive success. We put in a number of COVID parameters for the public. And as of this date, we've had a near completion of compliance from every chiropractor in the state in terms of those precautions. Moving forward, a couple of areas to really concentrate on is helping people get off of opioid medications, finding a really cost-effective way to do that through chiropractic. And in doing that, hoping to eliminate a lot of addiction problems while also saving quite a bit in terms of insurance and reimbursements for non-necessary care if some of these problems are solved at an immediate level. And it's been a joy working the last year, certainly your consideration for continuing with the board. And if you have any questions, certainly would like to answer those as well.
Are there questions? Seeing none, thanks for being here. Our next appointee is Kristen Try. Miss, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Kristen Try. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've been a massage therapist since the spring of 2016. I was appointed to the board actually right as COVID hit, and I've been serving through the last year trying to navigate the COVID experience through massage therapy and just contributing what I can to help with this new board getting established and helping massage therapists work at a more legitimate and professional level.
Well, thanks, Ms. Try, and thanks for your service on that important board. I don't see questions from committee members. So next up is Lena Lafferty with the Board of Nursing. Ms. Lafferty, if you're online, please proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Governor Dunleavy has appointed me to the registered nurse position on the Alaska Board of Nursing. I was nominated July 2019. I've come to know the current board members, and in my opinion, this board has made great strides in adapting nursing regulation during the current pandemic while ensuring safe nursing practice in Alaska. I'm a licensed registered nurse currently employed with Providence, Alaska in Anchorage. I've been a nurse for 6 years. I've been an Alaska resident since 2006. Before becoming a nurse, I served United States Navy as a hospital corpsman. I separated after 10 years to accompany my active duty husband, Marine. I worked at the Providence Transitional Care, and then I was selected as an operating room fellow, and I've been at the main hospital since for over almost 2 years. I'm very honored to be considered for this position, and upon confirmation by your committee, will advocate for the interests and people of Alaska. I'm fully committed to the Board of Nursing mission and will actively promote and protect the health of citizens of Alaska through the safe and effective practice of nursing as defined by law. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thanks, Ms. Lafferty. Are there questions from committee members? Not seeing any. Next up is Wendy Monrad. Ms. Monrad, are you online?
Yes, this is Wendy Monrad. I have been appointed by Governor Dunleavy back in March of 2019 to finish out my predecessor's term. So I had 1 year on that term and then was reappointed March of 2020, I believe. And so here for that reappointment. So I've currently already served 2 years on this board. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist, or CRNA, currently employed at the Alaska Native Medical Center. I've been a CRNA for 21 years and a registered nurse for 30 years. I have been an Alaska resident since 2002 when I moved up here with the United States Air Force. I separated from the Air Force in 2005, made my way to ANMC, and 2 years later went back on active duty with the Public Health Service. And retired recently from that service, from government service, so now I'm just a regular person. I've also served my professional organization both at the state and the national level, and have had roles at my job as a chief CRNA over the past 10 years. So the volunteering for this board position has been kind of a natural transition for me. I'm honored to be considered for a second term. And upon confirmation, I will continue to advocate for the people of Alaska.
Question, Representative Funnels.
Yeah, thanks for being interested in serving on this board. What's the most interesting thing that you've worked on since being on the board?
Well, interesting. I would say COVID. We spent a lot of time dealing with emergency COVID regulations over the last year, a lot of additional board meetings, a lot of regulation changes. So I would say definitely interesting is a good word for it. but it's definitely been the biggest challenge on the board. And then I think the most interesting for me really has been the telehealth.
Do you want to tell us what you thought was the most interesting part of the telehealth regulations?
I just think telehealth, you know, it's not a new practice. It's been around for quite a while, but it's just kind of been under the radar. And with COVID, it really came to the forefront, right? We really needed it, and we had to expand it in some respects, and that happened through the governor's 241 through Senate Bill 241 to open up those expansions during. And it's being looked at again now with current bills in session. And I have personally experienced some incredible telehealth care through our VA here in Anchorage. And it was so easy and so efficient that it's just kind of lit my fire for telehealth. And to see that appropriately regulated and our providers able to provide that care safely.
It's certainly been one of the silver linings of COVID. Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Shragi has a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Do you think we should be following CDC guidance and following their directives when it comes to medical advice, especially as it relates to COVID?
Absolutely. I think the CDC guidelines are important. You know, COVID has created so many questions about different organizations and different guidelines, but that has always been the standard in the background for medicine and for nursing practice. So I think we definitely have to fall in line with and consider those regulations while also being open to how it works in our state, if that makes sense.
Go ahead.
And may I ask, do you have a stance on whether or not hydrochloroquine is an effective treatment for preventing COVID-19?
Well, I do anesthesia for a living, so I do not have a stance on that. It's not in my practice, and we have not discussed that on the current board.
Okay. Thank you. I've been alerted to some social media that I believe is attributed to you that has promoted those treatments, and just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Chair, may I respond to that?
Please.
Sure. Go ahead, Ms. Monrad.
Okay. And I believe that was some time ago. early on, I would say probably last spring or summer. I don't really remember. And I will say this, that in medicine, there are differing opinions about what really works and what doesn't work and what's true science and what's not. And there's a lot of turmoil in the medical community with that. And so, you know, but like I said, with CDC, it's important to recognize that as a leader, has always been a leader in practice.
If I can just comment through the chair, I appreciate that response and appreciate what I take as a commitment to, align yourself with the CDC guidance and promote that guidance as provided by the CDC.
Thank you, Ms. Monrad, for being here and for answering questions from members. Next up is Michael Wilcher. Is Mr. Wilcher online?
I am indeed.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for this consideration. I've been in Alaska now 21 and a half years. I brought my wife and my two young sons here just on a whim. We decided to move to Alaska. I figured if we didn't like it, we'd go home. And we never did. Well, I shouldn't say we never did. I'm currently sitting home now in Pennsylvania in my car, but on vacation. But I've been a nurse for almost 26 years, and I've worked in everything from psych to orthopedics to urgent care, and currently I work for the Department of Veterans Affairs in Fairbanks, the VA clinic, and I have to say I really appreciate the previous gal's comments about our telehealth with the VA. We've worked really, really hard to make that work well in the VA system, and it has. It was a bit cumbersome at the beginning, but I think we've got it now to where it's a pretty well-oiled machine. So I will pass that on. As far as what I can offer and what I'd like to see is, number one, I can offer lots of experience of different aspects of nursing because I've done so many. And I've come in contact with lots of nurses that were satisfied with how things are going and some that weren't so satisfied. But some of the things that some of them have expressed frustration about was finding information that they need. And, you know, we have these regulations and we have these rules, but they're not always easy to find. And that can make it complicated for some people, just simple things like scopes of practice. Even my nurse manager has difficulty finding the scopes of practice for the nurses that work for her. And so I'd kind of like to see a little more, I don't want to call it transparency, so to speak, because I'm sure it's there, but it's not easy to find. And then, of course, addressing any disciplinary actions that may have to come up, as much as I hate to do that, but we do have to hold people accountable, and I certainly am in favor of that. If the regulations as they are were not followed. So that's what I have to offer. I thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Wilcher. Are there questions from committee members? Yeah. Representative Funnels.
Yeah, I'll just go ahead and ask Mr. Wilcher the same question, I guess, that Representative Schrage asked a previous candidate. Are you comfortable supporting and adhering to the CDC guidelines with regards to healthcare, including COVID care?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Wilcher, I guess I did look at some of your social media posts, one of which is referencing things I'm worried about, losing my constitutional rights, 100% worried about that, COVID-19 not worried, and I guess I would just echo the concern about some of the content, questioning the science of COVID, and appreciate the commitment to simply following CDC guidance and your role on the Board of Nursing.
Yeah, you know, I have no issue following the CDC guidance. I do it every day. I do it at work every day. When I look at things like that, my opinion or what my actual thoughts about something are have no impact on my job at work because I follow the guidelines of my job, and I continue to do that, and I would do that with the Board of Nursing. So
Okay.
If that's something that my job requires, then I absolutely follow that guideline.
Okay.
I'm not going to be the one to make those decisions, and I'll leave that up to them.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for that affirmation. Representative Nelson, did you have a question as well?
Yeah, I just wanted to see if we're able to have a copy of that
sure.
for the entire committee beforehand, or see where specifically you got that information from. But
I think it was a Facebook post.
Okay.
So happy to pass that around. Mr. Wilcher, thanks for being here. Thanks for answering questions. Next up is on the pharmacy board is Richard Holt. Mr. Holt, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Richard Holt. I've been a licensed and practicing pharmacist for over 20 years, which includes my time as a practicing pharmacist here in Alaska since 2011. I was initially confirmed to the Board of Pharmacy in March of 2016 and here to seek my reconfirmation to continue my time with the board. While on the board, I've participated in legislative testimony process. I've participated in writing law questions for inclusion on the multi-state jurisprudence exam for pharmacists wishing to become licensed in Alaska. I've presented continuing education to licensees on behalf of the board as it relates to our regulatory activity. I've been a past chair and current chair for the past 3 years. I'm very active in drafting regulation topics for the board and presenting them to the board for review. And I have acted as an initial board member review in cases brought forward by state investigative teams. So in sparing some time, I'm sure there's plenty of other things I could go through, but I believe I still have many areas where I can contribute to the healthcare of Alaskans and the practice of pharmacy in Alaska. And with that, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thanks. Questions for Mr. Holt? Seeing none, Mr. Holt, thanks for being here. Next up is Justin Ruffridge. I think he's actually going to join us next week. Not seeing him on the list. Okay. So, next up after Mr. Ruffridge is Denise Albert with the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Ms. Albert, are you online? And if so, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, representatives. Thank you for your time here today. My name is Dr. Denise Albert, and I have served on the Alaska Board of Veterinary Examiners for the past year. I understand that you have my CV in front of you, so I'll try not to be redundant. I have prepared a statement as follows. I've been in veterinary practice for 35 years. 26 years ago, I came to Alaska from Boston, Mass. In 1995 to volunteer as a trail vet on the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and continued to do so for 15 years thereafter. In the meanwhile, I moved to the state, bought land in Denali near the national park, built a house with my partner, Mark Nordman, and have been practicing small animal medicine in Alaska for 20 years. This time, I'm semi-retired, doing clinical relief work and some consulting in Denali with the Kennel of Sled Dogs who patrol the national park. With a little more time available, I was searching for a way I might help the public and the veterinary community. A colleague recommended that I apply to fill the seat that opened in 2020 on the board, and after speaking with past members regarding what was involved in the position, applied and was appointed. As you may have noted on my resume, I've served in the profession in multiple capacities and in numerous locations across the U.S. This has provided a broad view of the field, which is hopefully helpful in considering issues. Attention to detail and a comprehensive view has always been my approach, typically requiring all available facts in an effort to create the optimal plan of action. I believe this trait enhances my contribution to decision-making on the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Making good decisions in the public interest simultaneously supports the veterinary profession in our state. The past year of service on the board has been a steep learning curve, but the board members have been welcoming and supportive through my initiation to the process. It's been a great opportunity to learn, expand my experience and knowledge while being a part of decision-making that impacts the public and my profession daily. Thank you for considering me to continue in a seat on this board, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Ms. Albert. Representative McCarty.
So thank you, Dr. Albert. Thanks for your contribution to Eagle River. I know that you're highly regarded for what you've done there. Do you see any specific things that are needs for our state as a veterinarian?
Well, we're certainly working on multiple regulations to try and refine them so they are more clear and direct and most suitable for the state. That covers many areas. Primary ones right now are the veterinarian-client-patient relationship. Well, these are the two we spend most time on, and the addressing the opioid crisis, how that is affecting the whole Alaskan population as well as the country.
Yes.
Just to follow up with that, I know we have a bill regarding that not make it mandatory for veterinarians to record or report on the medications for animals. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I support the bill. And the reason is, the first impression that someone might get is, oh, great, anything that will help the opioid crisis. However, in our situation, when one looks closer at it, this program was created with human medicine in mind. It's directed at human medicine. There are many places where we vary from human medicine. A turtle is not a cow, is not a dog, is not a human. They're all different species, and unfortunately there's many misunderstandings about what veterinarians do with narcotics and drugs and necessary treatments for animals. They require vastly different quantities and forms and combinations, and veterinarians in doing their day-to-day job can easily fall into problems because of the way that the PDMP has addressed human medicine. Once again, we don't use the same units. The programs which have been designed, the computer programs are designed, directed at human medicine. It's become problematic so that economically looking at it, it requires, it's kind of a labor sink for us, and it ends up becoming so frustrating for many in practice that they end up throwing up their arms. I mean, veterinarians are typically fairly intelligent and well-intended people. They generally follow the rules, and those people are getting totally frustrated by the program because it's working against their care for the animals that they care for, and therefore their owners, the public. There's a whole lot of aspects to this. I've only been on the board for the past year. Our chair and other members of the board are far more capable of conveying the scope of the problem for you, as they've been doing a lot more writing. But it is a topic of discussion constantly. Veterinarians are such a small percentage of the opioid use, and there are already many, many states across the country which have exempted veterinarians for these reasons and others.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and, oh, okay, Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, all right. Dr. Albert, do you acknowledge that that we have an opioid problem in the state of Alaska?
Absolutely.
Do veterinarians prescribe opioids to animals that you provide care to that can and have been consumed by adults, humans?
Can and have been? You mean
that can be?
Mm-hmm. Well, we use the same drugs. Okay. Many of the.
Okay, so you use some of the same drugs, and are you aware that the PDMP allows you to have to delegate data entry into the PDMP to some of your office personnel?
Well, not to office personnel. It has to be a licensed veterinary technician.
Okay, so you're aware that you can delegate to a licensed veterinary technician?
Absolutely aware of that. Yes.
And so so you agree we have a problem that veterinarians prescribe medications which can be consumed by adults and which have been, I'm going to just insert that, are abused by adults, and that you can delegate that work. You said that you don't prescribe that many opioids. Is it possible then it's not really as onerous as maybe is being suggested?
It's not that we don't prescribe that many opioids. What's happened is that veterinarians have backed off of prescribing opioids simply because of these problems. And so animals, I feel terrible about that, but a great majority simply have stopped based on the fact that this program is so problematic. And using a technician in order to do this is something that is, we're paying those technicians. Technicians' time is extremely scarce. So it does add considerable effort to the day-to-day function.
Yeah, Dr.
Thanks, Ms. Albert. Let's do one last question from Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, I got one last question.
Sure. Okay.
Is it possible that we could just change the way the program works for the purposes of veterinarians? I understand the program was designed for data entry relating to human patients, and that there's been some challenges with the data entry related to humans to animals because it was designed for humans. Isn't it possible that we could just modify the PDMP to make it easier for you to use, and we could sort of thread the needle there?
I would say that. That was possible. However, they've been working on that for 4 years, and it's really only recently that there's even been acknowledgement that there's a variation. We don't even use the same units.
You know that.
The morphine, the MMEs, which is used for a unit in human medical prescribing of narcotics and as an assessment, it's not used in veterinary medicine. It's not taught. It has no application for us.
Thanks, Ms. Albert.
The program could be changed. However, there has not been significant effort to do so.
One more question from Representative Kaufman, and then we got to move on. I just want to get through as many appointees to respect their time. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, it sounds like there may be an improvement project there that we might be able to work on. And I also noted the earlier comment about the percentage of the problem. So from a needs base, if there could be a way to know the volume of the drugs entering from the veterinary side of it versus the human medical side of it, there may be a less cause and effect from that angle.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. Next up, we're going to go to and thank you, by the way, Ms. Albert, for that lengthy discussion. Thanks for being here. Next up, we have Rachel Byrne-Gart, and then we're going to go to the Occupational Safety and Health Board. Yep. Ms. Byrne-Gart, are you online? Not seeing her. We have two more testifiers today, and then we'll be done. John Stallone, if you're online, the OSHA Review Board, please proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. I appreciate everyone's time today. I'm a fifth-generation Alaskan. I've been in safety and health, occupational safety and health, for a greater part of 22, 23 years. I've done everything from aviation to oil and gas to Department of Transportation. I'm now currently serving as the safety director for the North Slope Borough Water and Sewer Department. I've been on the compliance side for the private sector
as well as a compliance eye for the public sector, working for the actual ACOSH, the Alaska State Program, and the Indiana State Program. I've been on the other side of the seat, or the other side of the table during an OSHA review board. I feel like my time and my experience and over 400 cases I've completed and investigated and inspected, the things that I'm aware of, the constantly staying abreast of the new standards that are coming out in both 29 CFR 1910 and 29 CFR 1926. I have a wealth of knowledge, and I want to be an active participant in any cases that come before the board. I have a deep passion for this. You know, it's kind of the family business. My dad retired as the chief of OSHA back in 2006. My brother's an industrial hygienist for the Alaska Army National Guard, and I'm doing what I'm doing. So I appreciate your time, and if I'll go ahead and be quiet if anyone has any questions for me.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I see, you know, you were talking a little bit about your service with the Guard. Were you 74 series at all?
No, I was actually I was a loadmaster on C-130.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I saw the radiation safety officer, and then your time with the military consult. So I was just wondering.
Unfortunately, I've lived out of a suitcase for the last 20 years, so I've had about 100 different hats on my head at some point.
I'm right in the same boat with you. I just wanted to double check and reiterate that, and thank you for your service. It's always great to see you out there.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Nelson. Thanks, Mr. Stallone. So we will have to return to appointees next week. We got through most. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Sorry it takes some time. Representative Kaufman wants to make a comment, I think, before we go.
Yes, I just want to say thank you to everybody. We've gone almost from A to Z on a big volume, and I just want to thank all of the people that step up, put their name out there for public service, whether they were able to be here today or not. It's really something. I just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and I apologize that people sit around for 2 hours. I wish there was a more efficient way to do it. We haven't found it yet, but when we do, we will. Thanks for being here. It's 5:10. House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.